Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And pigs, I like to tell people, pigs aren't destructive animals, they're just really hard workers.
Josh Eganolf is trying to figure out how to be a good steward of his farmland while still letting his pigs be pigs. We'll visit with him today. We go inside the scientific process of creating new foods, how corporate profit plays a role in what we read on food labels, those stories from Harvest Public Media. Salmon turned into a sauce is paired with some gorgeous asparagus. That's what's on Chef Daniel Orr's menu today. He'll also show us a quick recipe for radish pickles. And cold brew coffee is a trend on the rise or on its way out. Jamie Ordonez talks to coffee people, big and small, to learn more. We'll hear the latest developments on the avian flu outbreak. But first, Luann Johnson has news of yet another company pledging to change its ways.
Foster Farms, one of the largest poultry producers in the U.S., has joined the ranks of companies cutting back on non-medical use of antibiotics for its chickens. The company said in a statement that it would introduce new product lines that would be free of antibiotics used in human medicine, except as a last resort in cases when the health of the flock is threatened. The move comes just 1 month after poultry giant Tyson Foods announced it would discontinue use of human antibiotics by September 2017. Pilgrim's Pride Corporation, the second largest chicken producer in the U.S., plans to stop using human antibiotics in its flock and to cut back on all antibiotics by 25% by 2019. Foster Farms has not announced a timeline for its proposed changes. The company came under sharp criticism after a massive outbreak of antibiotic-resistant salmonella was tied to its poultry products in the spring of 2014, triggering a recall. Egg imports from the Netherlands will soon be allowed under a new decision from the USDA. That's because the huge outbreak of bird flu in the Midwest has hurt supplies. The majority of the nearly 45 million birds killed off so far because of the avian flu were egg-laying chickens. So the huge outbreak has most affected what's called liquid eggs, used in commercial baking for products like bread, cookies, and crackers. Prices have doubled in the last month, and supplies have become very tight, says Corey Martin of the American Bakers Association.
We were essentially facing a couple choices. One is to shut down lines or shut down production altogether, and nobody wants to do that. Or two, find a substitute for eggs.
The USDA already allows imports from Canada and will now accept eggs from the Netherlands. But the slight supply increase isn't expected to help stem the rising prices at the grocery store. And the number of people with severe allergic reactions to particular foods is climbing. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that 15 million people and 1 in 13 children in the U.S. has food allergies. But researchers are fine-tuning a possible treatment that could curb the most severe reactions. Tina Dominguez, clinical manager and trainer at the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research, said by feeding tiny amounts of the allergens to patients and slowly increasing the dosage over weeks or months, the body can build up a resistance to the offending foods.
Giving them such a small amount that the immune system is actually not triggering a response, and it's, in a sense, working more as a training mechanism for the immune system to see that food is a non-threat.
Dominguez says it's difficult to pin down any single cause of the increasing numbers of food allergy sufferers because so many genetic and environmental factors could be in play. But she said changes in agriculture and the food industry over the last few decades have exposed people to new pesticides, food combinations, and chemicals that could help provoke these reactions.
In rural areas where people are still being raised on farms and they're being raised on food that is produced within that area and they're kind of, in a sense, living off the land, you're not seeing the diseases, especially food allergies, that we're seeing in the inner city and the highly populated areas.
The researchers at Stanford are experimenting with wearable Band-Aid patches that could slowly release amounts of an allergen to a patient to help them become more tolerant. Visit the website to get more info about these stories, eartheats.org.
And check us out on Twitter, at EarthEats. Add your voice to the conversation. All right, Luann Johnson with the news. Thanks.
See you in a week.
Sue supermarkets, convenience stores, and vending machines are full of packages containing ingredients you often can't pronounce. They're carefully developed and tested in a lab. So how do companies create things like instant noodle soup and frozen gourmet meatballs? Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer followed a group of students as they developed a new food product.
The food product development class at Iowa State University aims to give students a real-world experience of turning a creative idea into a viable product.
I'm thinking about cricket flour.
Yeah, cricket flour. On this first day, students are brainstorming. By the end of the semester, they'll present a packaged, tested, shelf-stable, or frozen item. Ultimately, this group decides against insect protein.
The market trend for the American economy is it'd be a little ahead of its time.
That's senior Nathan Davis.
So what we're working on now is like a Mexican version of sriracha sauce.
First, they mix up something from ingredients you might have at home. Fresh and canned peppers, spices, garlic. When they have a recipe they like, they conduct early market research. Professor Ken Prusha says that feedback is crucial.
But they have to show us data from consumers that they have a viable product that will differentiate themselves in the marketplace.
At the semester midpoint, the students present their concept, their product, and their data to a panel of food industry professionals. Prusha says it simulates what a research and development team might do within a company.
We have a brand new product from our lab today for you called Abrasa.
Panelists sample the Abrasa hot sauce on chips.
Did anyone find the sauce too spicy?
Okay.
The flavor profile was real even. I mean, it just really...
Some student groups are sent away with suggestions for radically changing their products. But Abrasa gets a green light from the panel. This is not a cooking or a recipe development class. It's food science. Getting a product from your kitchen to the grocery store takes a lot more than a chef's talents. Professor Lester Wilson co-teaches the course.
They move from fresh ingredients to industrial ingredients in scale-up. Also, they do larger batches, just like you would in industry.
Let's clarify what industrial ingredients are. Various starches, stabilizers, bitter maskers, and other additives. Elements that will keep a product looking, smelling, and tasting right as it endures packaging, shipping, and perhaps weeks on a shelf or in a freezer. The students have to identify the possible problems for their product and how they can address them. All the while, they must keep cost in mind. Dried, frozen, or canned ingredients are typically cheaper than fresh and available readily in larger quantities.
As often happens when you scale up from just a benchtop or a kitchen scale to a much larger scale, stuff happens.
On an April afternoon, the Abrasa group assembles in the commercial kitchen of a restaurant on campus. Emily Herban describes one of their challenges.
Our poblano peppers. We had been getting fresh poblanos, fire roasting them ourselves, and then grinding them up ourselves. Trying to find what's an industrial substitution of that, because fresh poblanos would have been really expensive.
They found individually flash-frozen, fire-roasted poblano peppers in 1-kilogram bags. Those get ground in a food processor, while canned chipotles are pushed by hand through a sieve. When all the ingredients are mixed together, they calculate how much of those additives they're going to need. Potassium sorbate, xanthan gum, and carrageenan gum should keep the product from separating and ensure it stays liquid. But when they bottle up the sauce, they hit a snag. Here's student Nathan Davis again.
We had some issues with gelling, and we're going to talk about that in the board meeting. So, I mean, it's safe to eat. Yeah, it's just the squirting.
And that matters when you're trying to sell a squeeze-top bottle, not just impress your friends with a new hot sauce. So this product couldn't quite make it to the marketplace as is. At a food company, Abrasa would be headed back to the test kitchen. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Later on, we'll hear another story from Amy Mayer about how consumer demand for certain types of food influences the creation of new products. You might have noticed a new beverage appeared on certain Starbucks menus this past spring, cold brew coffee. Not to be confused with iced coffee, cold brew is steeped for a long time using cool water, and that lessens the coffee's acidic bite. Some might say Starbucks was a little behind the times, as cold brew has been the coffee beverage of choice at many small coffee shops around the country for years. Jamie Ordonez has more about where the cold brew trend could be going.
Some may say that coffee makes life possible. I may agree. Whether I make it at home, get it from the gas station, or pay $5 for it at a fancy coffee shop, I'll get my coffee any way I can. So I'm no coffee snob, but I met someone who is.
It's the second part of Sam, Yule, and when you drink the coffee, you'll zing.
Samuel Sven is the owner of Yule Zing Coffee Lab in Bloomington. He opened his business in 2013 selling only cold brew coffee. But don't confuse that with iced coffee. Iced coffee is usually just leftover hot coffee poured over ice.
But with cold brew, it's a totally different process. It's actually brewed cold in a walk-in cooler where you use way more coffee, like five times the regular ratio of coffee, and then you steep it for anywhere from like 12 to 24 hours.
Sam says the result is about 60% less acidic than hot brewed coffee. Yule Zing isn't the only place making cold brew. It's actually become a national trend. Stumptown Coffee is a company that originated in Portland in 1999. They focus on the direct trade coffee market and handle coffee with care from when it's grown to what it tastes like. They started cold brewing in 2011 to balance the demand for cold coffee in the summer. Sam uses 5-gallon buckets for his cold brewing.
We started that way too, so it's pretty common.
But that's not feasible for Stumptown, according to cold brew director Diane Aylesworth. The pioneering coffee company now has shops in LA, Seattle, and New York, and bottles their cold brew wholesale nationwide. They've come a long way in 16 years.
So we have ramped up with various brewing equipment over the past couple years. We've used everything from wine fermentation tanks. We've moved into traditional beer brewing equipment.
Sam thinks that cold brew coffee is exotic in Bloomington, but that more quote-unquote hip places are moving away from the trend.
In high snobbery, or I don't know, in real third wavy kind of, you know, purist coffee culture, cold brew is actually kind of so 5 years ago. And the reason is because of that low acid, it actually can kind of take away some of the bite to the coffee. So like, which is especially applicable to some of the real sweet coffees, like an Ethiopian or some of the Central American stuff, where there's a big fruity, citrusy or berry-like note, that acid stuff can actually kind of make it a little bit brighter and crisper.
But Diane disagrees. She explains that nationwide, cold brew is still growing and doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon.
We've been growing at a rate typically of doubling or tripling our business each year on the cold brew side.
Now that everyone knows about cold brew, what can we look for as the next big trend in coffee?
We see a few people playing around with something called cascara tea. And what that is taking the cherry from the coffee plant, drying it, and then making a tea from it.
Diane says Stumptown is playing around with it in-house. And Sam showed me the cascara tea that he has in his lab, too. For Earth Eats, I'm Jamie Ordonez.
Jamie worked with Earth Eats this past year as our intern. She's off to big things in New York City, so be sure to keep an ear out for her stuff. Thanks for all your work, Jamie. Coming up.
There we go. Now, it looks like a, you know, kind of very unassuming mayonnaise-type sauce, but I think when you taste it, you're really going to enjoy it.
Especially if you like salmon, this recipe is for you. Daniel Orr will make it for us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Okay, you ready?
Annie Corrigan here with Chef Daniel Orr. It's Earth Eats.
I'm going to show you a recipe that my friend Mihoko taught me how to make when I was living in New York City and had a rooftop penthouse garden. So this is a sun-pickled radish. She did it with the daikon radish. Daikon is this big radish you can see here. It's almost like a baby's arm.
A muscular baby at that.
A little Arnold Schwarzenegger baby. All right. So you can use that, and that's what I traditionally use. But this year at Kolb Homestead, our farm, we're getting all these little long radishes. These are 2.5 to 3 inches long, red, really, really pretty. What you do is you take your radishes, and I put them in a plastic container. Okay, now we're going to put quite a bit of salt, okay? And we're just going to rub that salt into the radishes. This is going to help the salt permeate the radish and start drawing out the liquid. And then you're going to go put this in the sunniest part of your yard, or if you live on a rooftop like I used to, put it on the rooftop. Now, things happen outside that don't happen inside, like bird flyovers and things like that. So what I always do is put a piece of cheesecloth on top so nothing can go in there. And you leave them out there for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And what you get is I've got some that we did. And you can see how they've shriveled up, dried up. Then what you do is you finish it. Some rice wine vinegar, some sugar, and some ginger. If you want to make them spicy, you could put some crushed red pepper flakes on there too. And I'm going to let you try one of these little sun pickles.
Still crunchy.
These will last a long time. Now you could put them in a jar, keep them in the fridge. But I serve these chopped up fine on top of my pea soup. It'd be great to have on a sushi platter.
Daniel has another suggestion for how to serve these little flavor bullets. Another recipe with him coming up at the end of the show. Walk down a grocery store aisle today, and you're likely to find lots of food and lots of marketing claims. Whether a product says it's low-fat or produced without hormones is largely governed by two issues, consumer demand and corporate profit. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explores how those factors influence new food creations.
When the timer goes off in this lab kitchen, students in Iowa State University's food product development class remove from the oven yet another iteration of their pizza crust.
Look at that.
It's not a perfect circle, and it's not cooked exactly evenly.
It's still pretty. Oh, wait. It's crispy on the outside, but
Cassie Rickliff says it doesn't behave like normal pizza dough because of the unique gluten-free recipe.
The crust is made out of cauliflower instead of like regular flour.
This class gives students an idea of what goes on in the product development labs of major food companies. Their charge? Invent something new. Like the pizza group, many started with consumer trends. Dairy-free, whole grain, high fiber.
Today we're going to be introducing you to Simple Virtues. Honestly good, honestly green.
These students are presenting their snack idea, Simple Virtues, red pepper hummus surrounded by crackers made green from spinach and kale.
You can see that it features our gluten-free, vegan, allergen-free formula.
But food industry panelists who evaluate the projects at mid-semester, as higher-ups in a company might, are concerned the name Simple Virtues could be misleading. Here's Terry Vanderpool of Wells Enterprises.
Simple to a lot of people means 5 ingredients or 7 ingredients or, you know, things I can pronounce.
Once they settle on a product, the students must figure out whether it's economically practical to create their recipe at a commercial scale. Virginia Tech professor Courtney Thomas studies politics around food labeling. She says companies, just like these students, will often develop something new in response to consumer interest or demand. But jumping on a trend is not necessarily quick or easy.
The tweaking that has to go on in this product formulation as you try to capture parts of the market is something that I don't think most people think about when they think about what they're buying and when they look at those labels.
But formulation is what these students are razor-focused on. They're fluent in the language of stabilizers and starches, pH, and moisture migration. To make pizza crust from cauliflower, these students use a commercial dryer to dehydrate a puree. That creates a crumbly, dry ingredient that mixes with the egg, cheese, and herbs to create something that very much resembles a traditional pizza crust. It's a hit when the food industry panel comes back to campus at the end of the semester. Jonte Jones works at Tone's Spices in Ankeny, Iowa.
the idea of drum drying or creating an extremely dehydrated product, adding the water back in, I think was brilliant. And the end product was really flavorful. It was really good.
Meanwhile, the Hummus and Cracker Group opted to change their name. Simple is gone. Now they're H-squared, Hummus Harmony. The package says, vegan, gluten-free, whole grain, good source of fiber. Even if most people don't care about those features, the small minority who do are often willing to pay more.
Retailers are aware of these consumers and want to be able to market products to them.
That's Carmen Bain, an Iowa State sociologist who studies food movements.
And there's some really good data that shows just how profitable this is.
For companies, profit is the holy grail of new food products. But most of us aren't paying any attention to that when we rip open the package. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More stories like this one from around the food and farming world at harvestpublicmedia.org. Josh Eganolf has been raising animals for 4 years with his wife, Laura Beth Wayne. It's the Wayne Eganolf Farm, or Wee Farm, in Owen County, Indiana. Throughout that entire time, they've always raised pigs farrow to finish, which means piglets are born on their farm, and that's where they live until it's time for slaughter. But Josh has been thinking about changing their philosophy on pigs because of the impact it's having on their land. Wee Farm is spread out over 150 acres, so we hop into Josh's pickup truck to go find the pigs. It was mid-March when I visited him, and they were in the midst of farrow season. They have six sows who provide 30 to 60 piglets for their meat sales annually. There are several adolescent pigs romping around the pasture today. These are Hereford Tamworth crosses that were born before Christmas. They spend almost all of their time outside, eating, rooting, and doing things pigs naturally do. Their impact on the land is obvious.
We had vegetative cover there in February when I started to turn the pigs out of the barn. We gave them access to the outside pen, and just in a matter of a month, it's gone from being fully vegetated and having good cover to, I would say, probably 90% of the vegetative cover is gone now.
This is the lot next to the nursery.
And pigs, I like to tell people, pigs aren't destructive animals. They're just really hard workers. And so you just have to direct their efforts, you know, and that's what we're trying to figure out how to do better.
Pigs can actually help restore the land. Farmers can use them like tractors to till up their land. Then you cast down seeds and let the pigs use their hooves to press the seeds into the soil. They've just planted their own crops, take the animals away from that land, bring them back 45 to 60 days later, and let them harvest the crops themselves. Josh is still trying to figure it all out.
And it's funny, you had to look back to literature from like the 1940s and 1950s to find guidance on how to best do that, because pork production has shifted in America. It's all in confinement now. We can hop out here. This is the nursery, the pig nursery.
They raise a variety of heritage breeds on Wee Farm, from Hereford and Berkshires to large blacks.
Come on, girls. Little pig. It's my unoriginal pig call. Come on, pigs.
The problem is his land never gets a break. During the growing season, it's fine. He can sow seeds and move the animals around. But in the wintertime, they decimate all the crops and nothing grows back.
There's always a tension for us between care for the land and maintaining a high level of animal welfare for our pigs. And what we found is if you put the animals in a high welfare situation, which is totally letting them live outside year round, they're really pretty hard on the land, you know, can be destructive.
The alternative is to keep them inside more of the time, and he doesn't like that option either. In the barn, there is one sow and one piglet who's not quite ready to be outside yet. The farrowing stall looks like a comfortable space to spend time. Lots of straw to lay on, plenty of room to move around.
So this sow is a first-time mama. This sow had some problems, and we only ended up with one surviving piglet out of, I think, the seven that she gave birth to.
That's another reason Josh is considering changing his pig operation. It's a gamble to raise pigs from birth to slaughter, a gamble that didn't pay off in this case. Instead, buying 50 piglets per year is more of a sure thing than farrowing on their farm.
I think the future for us is to buy young piglets in the spring, start to turn them out on the land, rehabilitate the land as we go, and finish those pigs on the nut fall.
Like acorns and hickory nuts, He'll then take them to slaughter so there are no pigs on the farm in the winter and the land has that time to regenerate. He has plans to go back to the farmer who originally sold them their first pigs he started raising 4 years ago, so these new piglets will be of the same genetic stock as the pigs he's raising now. Thanks so much to Josh Eganolf of We Farm. We've got pictures at eartheats.org. All right, time to get out your high-powered blender. Daniel Orr's Vitamix is a workhorse in his kitchen. You'll need it for this mousseline recipe. He's making a light, airy, foamy sauce with smoked salmon. Now, this is cool.
So what we're going to do is we're going to take 3/4 pounds of salmon, put that in our blender. Then we're going to add about 1.5 to 2 cups of milk. We also have 1/4 teaspoon of curry, 10 drops of hot sauce. We're going to add a little bit of salt. The salmon's already salty, so you don't want too much. And we're going to let that blend. Start it on slow. And then you're going to increase the speed. Take it on super high. Okay, Annie, so if you look down here, you can see that it's gotten thick, a little pink from the salmon. Do you like salmon, Annie?
Oh, I love smoked salmon. I'm sort of, I'm feeling a little offended that you're sort of pureeing it into a sauce because I love it so much just on bagels with cream cheese.
Well, this is also a great way to, like, use up the little scrappy pieces. I'm going to add a little lemon juice and about 1/4 cup of heavy cream. Turn it back on low. Got some warm asparagus. And I'm going to spoon over the smoked salmon mousseline. We're going to garnish it with just a couple pink peppercorns, a little bit of chives, and some chive flowers.
Speedy.
There we go. Now, it looks like a, you know, kind of very unassuming mayonnaise-type sauce, but I think when you taste it, you're really going to enjoy it. The plate's very hot, so be careful.
Woohoo! That's incredible. Oh, my goodness.
Really simple.
Check out the picture of this on the website. The mousseline is served on top of some beautiful, fresh, green asparagus. And those pickled radishes, you'll see slices of those scattered around the dish. Both recipes, you can follow them at eartheats.org. Our great group of hard workers includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another week in the books. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today. Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.